Sambuddhassam. Namo tassam bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassam. Buddhang dhammang sanghang gunuttarang upacchayang namassami. In Thailand, people complain about my talks these days. They say I don't tell enough stories. One of the reasons is most of the stories are already written down. And sometimes people say, that was a really good story, but I think I preferred it in the book, so I lose a bit of inspiration to tell stories. So I'm going to tell one anyway. This evening, because earlier today I was in discussion, having a chat with Professor Danto, and we were discussing calligraphy. Now, one of my favorite stories is a calligraphy story, so I'd like to tell you this story. And it's about a miserable old lady who nobody likes, living in a little village in Japan. And savior of miserable old ladies is either usually a dog or a cat or a grandchild. And she had the fortune to have a grandchild. And she was very, great deal of joy with her grandson. All her hopes were focused on her grandson. And her grandson showed a gift for calligraphy from an early age. And she was determined that she would get him enrolled with the greatest master of calligraphy in the capital city. Whether it was Tokyo or Edo, I can't remember. But how to get some kind of a way into such a prestigious school for a poor old woman living in the countryside. That was the question. And then she remembered, she thought of a relation of hers who was a monk in a neighboring province and also having somewhat of a reputation as a calligrapher. So she went to see him and she said, would you be kind enough to write a letter of introduction for my grandson? I think he would make a great calligrapher. To study at the great college. And a distant relative, the monk, agreed. But to her horror, rather than picking up one of the beautiful brushes that usually used for Japanese calligraphy, he picked up a pencil, sharpened pencil, wrote something on a piece of paper, put in an envelope, and said, take this with you. And she was mortified, upset, angry. She felt slighted. And all her hopes seemed to evaporate. He couldn't even write a few words, a few characters in a proper pen. So, anyway, what else to do? She went to the college, and great embarrassment, trepidation, offered this letter to the great master. The great master glanced at it and said, if the writer of this letter guarantees or introduces this young man, then it's good enough for me. The old lady was absolutely shocked and overjoyed. College and went home. So a few months passed and people started to notice this change in this old lady. And people started to go around the house and people with problems would go and ask her advice. And people wanted to do a shopping for her and just wanted to be around her. And a relative who was aware of her former reputation and fierceness and miserableness, was really taken by the change. And over a cup of tea, she asked the old lady, what's happened in your life? I thought you'd be very lonely, even more miserable without your grandson. And she said, well, that day when I took my grandson to visit my distant relative, the monk, and he took out that old pencil, he sharpened it, and he wrote that letter, my world just fell apart. I was so upset and angry and thought it was a waste of time going to this, to the master. And I was completely wrong, utterly wrong. And I came back and I thought, I'm like that old pencil. I've spent my life like a blunt old pencil, thinking that I'm just this hopeless old woman who has nothing to contribute, there's nothing to live for, I can't really do anything with my life. And yet, just as that, my relative, the monk, sharpened the pencil and made such beautiful calligraphy that the greatest master in the country took my son like that without a second thought. And then why can't I just sharpen the pencil of my own life and write something beautiful in the years that remain to me? This is one of my favorite stories. And I'd like to tell you this right at the beginning, otherwise I sort of wander here and there and I never get around to telling this story. For many of us, many people, unfortunately, live through that life without having that wonderful life-changing experience or the merit, the parami, to have that sudden insight. But it points to something central in our understanding of life as Buddhists. That is our capacity for change. And we don't have to be victims of circumstance. We don't have to be dragged down by all the negative forces that can often seem to surround us. And that it is in seeking to actualize, to realize that potential for change, that we create something beautiful and noble, but we most truly express our humanity. To sum up the goal of our life as Buddhists, one short phrase which crops up in almost every ceremony that we participate in. It says very beautifully, for the welfare and for the happiness of all sentient beings, for all time. And that encapsulates our inspiration and our direction. For welfare, for happiness, for ourselves, for others, for ever, or let's say sustainably. The Buddhism often viewed as a very personal, or inner, solipsistic, even selfish pursuit, but examination the breadth of the Buddhist teachings disproves that notion. For example, there are four virtues which are considered to be fundamental. Firstly, to a fortunate rebirth. secondly, to realization of stream entry. And they are firstly, satta, faith, secondly, sila, the restraint, the education of conduct and speech, thirdly, jhaka, generosity, renunciation, giving up that which is harmful and toxic in our lives, and wisdom. So in a famous sutta, the Buddha said, how do we repay the debt of gratitude we owe our parents? He said, you could carry them around on your shoulders all of your life and take care of their physical needs to the very last detail, but you wouldn't by that action, repay even a small part of the debt of gratitude you owe them. But if through your life, through your conduct, through your speech, through who you are, you inspire your parents to have more faith and confidence in Buddha Dhamma Sangha, to be more careful of their actions and speech, to be more generous, to be wiser, then you would repay that debt of gratitude. So these four virtues are, as I say, central to life as Buddhists, whether as lay Buddhists or as monastics. And if we look at those four virtues, the first and the last, faith and wisdom, are primarily internal factors. But sila and jhaka are concerned with our relationship with the world around us, and the community, society in which we live. Sila is voluntarily taking on ourselves an education of our conduct, one in which we refrain from certain acts, certain ways of speaking, and we learn to restrain ourselves within boundaries that we have freely chosen. And our sila is not a matter of blindly following rules and regulations, because the Buddha made it clear that if we have the wrong motivation in keeping precepts, for instance, out of fear of punishment, or out of desire for some reward or other, then our sila becomes impure. If if we consider that because we keep precepts or because we have a high standard of morality, then we're better than someone who doesn't keep precepts, then by that attitude, our sila becomes impure. So sila must be chosen. It must be voluntary for it to be part of the threefold training. And the keeping precepts requires patience, it requires mindfulness, it requires contentment, it requires training of the heart. So in the threefold training of sila, samadhi, panyara, this is not a step-by-step progression. It's merely that in certain areas of our practice, sila is prominent, and the training of heart, samadhi, and training of wisdom is secondary. In certain areas of our life, samadhi training, the training of the heart, virtue, inner virtues, is prominent, and the sila and panya aspects are secondary or are supportive. And similarly with wisdom, sila and samadhi are supportive. So Buddhist morality, sila, leads to trust in communities, leads internally to an absence of guilt, it leads to self-respect. We become friends to ourselves. We begin to like ourselves when we know that whatever the external circumstance, whatever the temptation, that we can maintain a standard of conduct which we have freely chosen. This is the role of sila. So it's dependent upon sentient beings. We keep sila in regard to our relationship to those around us. Jhaka, generosity, giving. This wonderful quality of the heart. And the Buddha at one point said that one who has possessive heart, one who is stingy and mean, cannot realize the jhanas, cannot experience deep samadhi. This is why giving, material giving, is the first expression of right view and understanding. When I was first in Thailand, the village, monastery were very poor, very, very difficult conditions. We had no electricity. The villages were very poor. Many of you have been to Thailand, and you can picture the scene. 5:30 or so in the morning, the monks walking out of the forest, walking to the local village, forming into a line and walking into the village. And there are people squatting down by the side of the road at regular intervals, waiting for the monks. The first thing people do is, when they get up in the morning, is make some sticky rice and then walk out to the front of the house, and say good morning to their neighbors and wait for the monks to come. So they start off their day with an act of generosity. And in those days, particularly, people were so poor that most householders would only have rice. And they'd have like a lump of sticky rice, and they'd check out the number of monks who were coming, 4 monks, 5 monks, and they'd make 4 or 5 little lumps. And then you put a lump in each monk's bowl. And so enough for 4 or 5 small lumps of sticky rice. That's an act of generosity that was open to even the poorest person in the poorest village. People rarely had cash, rarely had money, but they had rice. And so you found in the people materially poor, but through this act of giving every morning, they had the sense of pride and participation, and that they were supporting the monks. They played a part in the life of the monks and the monks' meditation and the monks' religious activities. But lump by lump of rice, they created and sustained this conventional identity of themselves as givers. So from outside you see, oh, a poor person living in a shack, you know, 1 buffalo, a couple of acres of rice paddy, nothing at all. But these people, through the act of giving, feel themselves to be essentially givers. Someone who has something to give to the world, someone who has something to give to the sasana. So this is a beautiful expression of jhaka, how jhaka is nurtured. And it through external actions, we change our sense of ourselves. So it's not just that the internal training is affecting our actions, but the opposite is happening as well. So jhaka and the sila are aspects of the path which are fundamental in securing a fortunate rebirth, if that is the extent of one's exasperation. It's a legitimate but inadequate aspiration. An aspiration for stream entry and for enlightenment, then these are the same virtues to develop, and they are the virtues which are most prominent, salient in stream entry. So the inner practice and the outer practice, inseparable, always nourishing each other and informed by right view. So this, I was thinking about this thing you hear, if you give a man or you give somebody a fish, you feed them for a day, you give them a fishing rod, then then they can feed themselves for their whole lifetime. But from a Buddhist point of view, so you give them a fishing rod and they feed their family for a whole lifetime, but they create such bad karma by doing so that it will take a long time before they get a favorable rebirth again. Killed so many fish. So with right view, it's not just giving, but it's intelligent and giving based upon understanding of the law of karma. So we seek to develop our own welfare and happiness, and the welfare of happiness in others, not just in short term, but in long term. And I think one of the encouraging reflections that we can pursue is that ultimately the path of Dhamma is one that becomes clear and obvious through observation, and that we all have the capacity to observe and to learn. We are learning creatures. And this is how we grow. We learn. We're, many animals learn all they need to learn or can learn within the first few hours or days of their life. Human beings, we can learn until the very end of our lives, the very last breath of our lives, like the old lady in the story. And the one time I was following Ajahn Chah on arms round, and he said to me, Buddhism is the only path of study in which you graduate. There's no graduation in any other worldly, in any worldly discipline. And the one of the words used to refer to the arahant is the asaka pugala, the graduate. So this is very much our understanding of life as Buddhists. We're students of life. And we learn about life most effectively and profoundly when we enter the classroom at the present moment. This is why that being in the now and present moment is not some mystic goal of practice, but it's the basic foundation for any effective learning. What is understanding dukkha, the arising of dukkha, the ending of dukkha, the path leading to the cessation of dukkha. We look and we observe. So rather than become very sort of holier than thou, and you know, you're telling people that you're caught up in these foolish sensual pleasures and you should put them all behind you and grow up and pursue the spiritual glories of the peaceful mind, then I think it's a lot more useful and real to say what's really going on, these things that you pursue and which you believe or hope will provide you with happiness. Do they? Do they really? Look. You don't have to believe the Buddha. You don't have to believe Buddhist monks. Look at your experience. Develop the capacity, develop the skills to sustain that inquiry into what's going on. And I believe that if we look very clearly, we begin to see, yes, a lot of the pleasures and the enjoyments that we seek consistently disappoint us. And yet, because we don't bring that clear and honest appreciation of what's going on to bear on this continual futile search, then we never develop the courage and the willingness to let it go and look for something more worthwhile. One of the teachings that I think we can perhaps overlook or perhaps not quite recognize is the importance of seeing defilement as defilement, seeing kilesa as kilesa, in order to let it go. It's just quite a uninteresting or kind of normal thinking in Thai, just a tamada kind of statement. But the value of developing an inner calm, even a temporary, short-term experience of the mind unburdened by thoughts and memories and imagination and desires and fears and so on, is that you have a new perspective on everyday mental states. Without that, you can't really experience the meaning of the word defilement. You have an intellectual understanding of it, certainly. But that sense of mental states sullying, staining the mind, only becomes experientially valid when you have an experience of the unstained or the unsullied mind. When we understand how certain mental states stain, sully the radiance of the mind, when we experience that radiance undimmed. An analogy that I might give you is that of child born and brought up in a terrible slum, never been anywhere in his life or her life, never known anything else. And then one day a kind person takes them out on a trip. They go out of the slum, out of the city, and into the mountains, fresh air, and get out of the car, take a deep breath of air. It's the first time I've ever had a lung full of fresh air. And it's the exhilaration of that the natural world. And suddenly the insight arises. That place where I've spent all my life is not a very nice place. It's smelly and dirty and so on and so forth. And even if that child had known, where do you live? I live in the slum. And yet, it's not an appreciation of just how desperate the situation is, because there's nothing to compare it with. So that nipita and disenchantment with this samsaric world of chasing after things and being disappointed and then trying, hoping next time, next time, next time. That becomes exposed when we have this experience of samadhi and know how to reflect upon it in the best possible way. Begin to see in the world that nothing can ever really be resolved nature of conditioned existence, the unresolvability of life. And so often we feel, oh, this is unresolved, that's unresolved, this is not yet quite worked out, and feeling burdened by that, worn down by it. But that's the way it is. Ajahn Lungpo Liam, who's I think been here before, he's he has a wonderful attitude to this. It's on his, one of his many building projects. Someone asked him, when will it be finished? And he said, well, I finish it every day. So the moment he walks off the building site, it's finished. He doesn't feel, oh, this has still got so much more to do, and that's so much more to do. It's, this much is finished. One of my favorite mental exercises is imagining I have a visitor from Mars. And, when you the effort to try to imagine yourself explaining things that you usually take for granted, or that you think that are obviously clear, and try to imagine explaining to someone who has absolutely no prior information. As a teacher, as a communicator, I think it's a very good exercise. So one of my imaginary scenarios is of explaining how parents bring up children from when they're born, and then they go through their childhood, adolescence, temporarily insane for a few years, and then sort of come around a bit, hopefully, and then physically and emotionally mature. And so, in this scenario, my friend, the Martian, looking at parents with children of 4 and 5 and 6, and says, oh, I feel really sorry for them. They've still got a long way to go before they finish their duty as parents. You know, so got all these unresolved parent issues. They've got years to go. See? And the obvious answer to that is, but no. I mean, I wouldn't. These are the best years of my life. You know, I don't want them to rush through being 4 or being 5 or being 6 or being 7. I mean, this is the most wonderful thing. I'd rather time slow down than speed it up. And the idea I'm trying to express here is that with raising children, we don't have the sense that we've got a job to do, and the sooner we get it over and done with, the better, and so much more that needs to be done. But we take joy in it year by year, and I'm seeing the growth of a child. And that's a kind of attitude to take with life in general. You know, it's this much. It's like this right now. And not constantly judging it, evaluating it in terms of what has yet to be done. In Thailand, we the family structure is still quite strong, and caring for parents is a big part of many people's lives. And something I've noticed over the years that those sons and daughters who put most time and most effort into caring for elderly parents tend to be the ones who blame themselves the most when the parents pass away, because there's always something more you could have done. There's always something you probably would have been better not doing or not saying. And this tendency to allow the mind to dwell on what has not been done, rather than to rejoice in what has been done, and then to push onwards. This is a negative and toxic habit of mine. We feel guilty. What does what does that mean when we feel guilty? Oh, I should have done this, or I should. What you're basically saying is, I should have been somebody else, which I hope you can see is patently absurd. Say, I should have done something else. When at that moment, you should have been wiser, you should have been better, you should have had more mindfulness. Well, why should you? At that particular point in your life, that particular day, why should you have been any wiser or mindful or better than you were? Because the amount of mindfulness, amount of wisdom, compassion, restraint, and so on and so forth, that manifested that at that particular moment were the result of all the moments of mindfulness, wisdom, compassion that had preceded it. It was the, we could say, the perfect or the only expression of all that had preceded it that was possible at that moment. So we're not making a person out of things, but we're seeing dhammas, the flow of dhammas. And again, teachings of anatta can seem very profound or even puzzling, intimidating, but anatta is simply pointing to the fact that something we think is there is not. It's not a state in itself. So an analogy here is a belief that the Yoga Samadhi Center here is infected with radioactivity. So Ajahn Siddhanta comes in with a Geiger counter and he walks all way around this room, all the way to the outer room, the toilets, on the roof, and he's covered every square inch of Yoga Samadhi Center. There's not been a single click. And he announces, it's okay, there's no radioactivity in Yoga Samadhi Center, or to use the Pali, it's up radioactive. That's what up means, it means not. So, it's nothing more than that. We think that there's this the person, the owner, the thinker, the doer, the one who is affects, is affected, and so on and so forth, and yet that is something that we're adding on to experience. In fact, what we think is there is not. If you don't believe it, look for yourself and see what you find. As we meditate more, and we're looking curiosity and interest and appreciation at whatever is arising and passing away, then we can see that thought arises before the sense of the thinker. The common sense tells us you need a thinker before you can think, you need a doer before you can do, and that's conventionally true. But just as there is a role and a time and place for the conventional world, we also need to find space in our life to transcend the conventional realities and to see what lies behind them. And we can see, yeah, that something just pops up. We do have words for this. And we say sometimes, it dawned on me, or it occurred to me. That's a really good one. Yeah, it just occurred to me. What do we mean? It occurs. And life occurs. It occurs, and then there's an us it occurs to. But life is occurring, and it's unresolved. Nothing is stable, fixed. And so the more we come into the present moment, the more we learn. We're ready to learn. Some more than 20 years ago, I was asked by the Wat Bapong, a long time ago, Wat Bapong Sangha, write a biography of Ajahn Chah, and my Thai writing skills were not so great that I felt very confident in. But for many years the preparation of the book consisted of conducting interviews with monks and lay supporters and family members and so on. And I remember distinctly interviewing Lumpo Sumedho on one of his visits down to Thailand, and him saying that what really impressed him about Ajahn Chah was that he was a master who facilitated learning. And I can remember at that point feeling this was rather demeaning. You know, it wasn't really giving Ajahn Chah the full credit. You know, he created situations for us in which to learn. I thought, well, surely it's more than that. But over the years, I've begun to see the profundity of that statement. Because that's what, in the end, that's all a teacher can do. He can create the optimum conditions for learning. And as students of life, we're constantly seeking to create for ourselves, to whatever degree we can, the optimum conditions for learning. I was speaking to someone earlier today, and I was what people think are meditation or peaceful states of mind are just like rarefied dullness. And one of the ways, people get being insecure here, or is that me? One way to tell the difference between a meditation practice which is consistent with sama samadhi, which is a samadhi which leads to liberation, expressed in the suttas in terms of jhana, but not necessarily the royal road or the way to jhana. Samadhi which is consistent sama samadhi is one in which emerging from samadhi, the mind is sensitive to the way things are. It's ready to learn. It observes. It is impressed by change, uncertainty, impermanence, imperfection, flawed nature of conditioned reality. It picks up on, it's impressed by the lack of an owner of experience, of a dictator, or one standing behind phenomena. So, although teachings on the three characteristics can seem somewhat difficult sometimes, that the mind which has been refreshed and stabilized and clarified and pacified by samadhi is one which is ready to learn. It's in a learning mode. So samadhi is the ultimate facilitator of learning. And it's a very profound strengthening of the facilitation provided by daily mindfulness practice. These things help each other. The changes of values and direction in life take place without forcing, without thinking, I'm Buddhist now. It just happens naturally. The more you look and the more you learn from life, from experience. And we can all do this. It's not beyond us. Going back to the Nichā Samādhi, or the dull, rarefied dullness, the sign of that is that when you come out of it, you feel like you just had a nap. You feel kind of relaxed and better than doing something really distracted, but it doesn't have any really purifying or clarifying effect on the mind. I just feel kind of good and relaxed, but it just stops there. So we'll say, well, how is it that some people are really immoral, and yet they seem to have good samadhi? You know, isn't that a contradiction? Doesn't that contradict what it says in the suttas? Yeah, this rarefied dullness, kind of pleasant, kind of, yeah. I mean, yes, that's not bad to immoral people who take no care over their conduct and their speech. They can calm the mind. Mentalize the confusion in their minds, but the kind of samadhi which opens the mind to the three characteristics that is only accessible to someone who has great care and respect to their quality of their actions and speech and the whole tenor of their life in society. So the practice is a learning practice and one of observation and creating the conditions in which you can most consistently observe in that way. So, yeah, when you sit in meditation, for instance, and your mind's very agitated, and rather than reacting against that, you just sit back and look at this, and what's going on in my mind is just going round and round about something that you said or didn't say, or someone else did, or someone else said. And then you conclude from that, oh yes, that's really true. If I'm not careful about the quality of my actions and speech, I screw up my meditation. I really need to give some attention to this, rather than just becoming frustrated and wanting to give up. Say, I can't meditate right now. You know, just too agitated. You know, just too much going on in my mind. So, you know, what is the view underneath that? Is the view is meditation is something you do in order to get something, and I don't think I'm going to get what I want from meditation. So why waste time? Do something else. So if we change that, this is a learning. Putting effort into our lives. We're learning skillful means of protecting the mind, not allowing wholesome, unwholesome dhammas from arising. But when they have already arisen, then the work, the learning is how to deal. What's the best way to deal with unwholesome dhammas that have already arisen? How can we practically develop the life skills to bring wholesome dhammas into the mind and take care of them and nourish them, develop them further and further. So this is a learning. So you often say to people in Thailand, you say, oh, you're not meditating because you're too agitated. That's saying like, I'm too ill to go and see the doctor. You know, so, yeah, I just feel lousy. I just couldn't make it to see the doctor. I'll wait till I get better and then go and see him. You know, so, yeah, I'm just too confused to meditate right now. Wait till I feel a bit more peaceful and then I'll meditate. It doesn't make sense. And the thing is, how can I do this? How can I sit with agitation and learn from it and learn how to be with it and learn how to let go of it? Now, so this is the attitude of Lumpur Liam, rather than saying, you know, how can I get the sala finished? It's not done. I've got all these pressures. You say, well, this is the work today. Yeah, I if you had to choose not to have to deal with depression and anger and so on. But you just got one mind. You know, this is what's happening today. This is what's going on. This is what I've got to learn from. And so, you know, there's no waste of time in this practice. There are some things that we enjoy learning and some things which are tough. But we can always have a sense, yeah, we're learning, we're looking. And our mind and our understanding and our practice is maturing through this sense of ourselves as students of life and seeing spiritual practice as the application of various wise means in order to further this learning. Learning that our values change, our conduct changes, our mind changes, and through this learning process that an old pencil becomes something to express the most beautiful calligraphy. So we all have that within us, and the more that we observe this flow of phenomena. There's no nouns in our life. There are only verbs. There's only this flow, and even the sense of being someone aware of the flow, is part of the flow, and you're seeing this flowing, 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 and you think, well, I'm like this, other people are like this. But, and the idea so-and-so is that way, and he's got this kind of personality, and that's both unwise and uncompassionate, because there is nothing we see for ourselves as a direct experience. There's no fixed person. And we're not unique in that. If we're not a fixed person, no one else is a fixed person. And so relating to others as their fixed entities is unwise, uncompassionate, and it is strengthening the very hindrances in our minds that we're trying to remove through meditation. See, how could they do such a thing? How could they say such a thing? Well, because at that particular moment, the power of defilement was stronger than the power of Dhamma. The moment you lose, mindfulness is lost, Hiri Otapa is lost, anything can happen. The unenlightened state is fundamentally insecure and unsafe. There are no guarantees. It's only the stream enterer who can be certain that no more can act in such a way as to cause intense suffering for self and others. But the unenlightened mind is still ungrounded and susceptible to defilement. It's like you've got the house with all the doors and windows open, and even though you really don't want the bad guys to come in, if you leave the windows and doors open, it may very well happen. So if we live, fortunately these days, we live in situations which it's easier to be virtuous and to be cruel and wicked, but that can happen, that can change at any time. Changes in the economy, in the society, in the climate, there are no guarantees. And rather than not wanting to hear that, or turning our back, it's just too depressing. We have to be able to take that on board. That is the only safety lies in the mind, which is free from defilement. So this is why this work is so important. And it's not something that anyone can do for us, is it? Even if you're blessed with a loving family, support from those around you, the key challenges in life you face alone, old age, sickness, death. There can be people around you, but that's you, that's your challenge, and you have to be up for it. You've seen people in intense pain, and it's they're on their own little island of pain, and somebody's even holding their hand and sort of wiping their brow and doing everything for them. But you can see for the person in pain, it's kind of thank you, but it's not really helping very much. These are things that have to sort out for ourselves. And the Buddhist teaching is that, good news, we can do it. We have within us the potential and the capacity to take responsibility for our lives and to transcend defilement. Because there is no defilement, no negative mental state which can withstand the power of the Dhamma. And there is no Dhamma, virtuous Dhamma, that cannot be cultivated in the human heart. When we look at teachers, great teachers, Ajahn Chah, he's so inspiring. And Ajahn Siddhanta is so inspiring. Rinpo Pasano is so inspiring. But what do we mean when we say that? What we mean is they embody virtues that are inspiring. It's the virtues that are inspiring, not the vessel for the virtues. So you'll say, oh, such and such a monk is so inspiring. Well, what? What's inspiring about them? Well, they're so calm, they're so kind, they're so compassionate, they're so wise. But really what we're saying is we're inspired by wisdom, we're inspired by compassion, we're inspired by kindness, and we're grateful to these individuals by manifesting those and allowing us to see how wonderful and beautiful those virtues are. But those monks, those nuns, those great teachers are not the possessors of those virtues. They're merely windows or merely vessels for us to see them and to see, well, if that monk and that nun and that great layman and the great laywoman can develop those things, can be vessels for those virtues, then why can't I? And Ajahn Chah would stress this very much. He said, when I was a young man, I was no different from all of you monks. The only difference is I just never gave up. I just kept doing it. I just never, ever gave up. I struggled. I fought. Until eventually I was able to transcend these defilements. It's doable. It's all doable. It's hard work. And it takes a lot of time. But if we can find that sense of pride, you know, wholesome pride and joy in the fact that, wow, it's just wonderful that I have the chance to do this, you know, step by step. It's not way up there someday in the future, you know, I'll achieve something right now. It's really kind of tough. But the very fact of moving along the path, if you're not walking, at least crawling along the path, you know, it's still the most wonderful. So I would like to share these words with you this evening and wish you all the best in your efforts to create happiness and welfare of yourself and your families, your communities, and society, short and long term. May you be well. Yes, now's the time if anybody wants to teach me something or discuss something or ask something. Yeah. Which Buddhist country? Yes, well, first thing that comes to mind is Suzuki Roshi's famous comment in the 1960s that, you know, you've got beginner's mind. So this is a problem with people born into Buddhist culture. They think they're Buddhist already, you know, rather than say it's something to achieve or something to manifest in their life. It's something that they've had since they were born. So teaching in Thailand, I say it's like this, you know, it's like someone who goes to a hospital, goes to see the director of the hospital, say, I'd like to be a doctor here. And said, well, yeah, have you graduated? What medical school did you go to? And he said, well, I haven't graduated. Well, oh, you're still a medical... No, well, I actually haven't really studied. My busy life, got a lot going on right now. I do plan to get round to it sometime. So, well, you know, how can you be a doctor here? And he said, well, I was born a doctor. My mum's a doctor, my dad's a doctor, my grandparents are doctors. We've been doctors for every generation for hundreds of years. So, I was born a doctor. And I said, to think you were born a doctor is no more absurd than say you were born a Buddhist. You're in a so-called Buddhist cultural environment, but being a Buddhist is a lot more than that. It means that you've won the first prize in the lottery, if you like. You've been born in a culture in which you have many of the supporting conditions to become a Buddhist. But whether or not you do so, that's up to you. And many people, unfortunately, choose not to or don't really see the value of it. Yes, just to recap one or two of the things that I spoke about last night. One is to, before going into difficult situations, just some few moments of preparation and looking at things in terms of those four right efforts. So just reviewing in previous on previous occasions what kind of hindrances or negative mental states have arisen in my mind. How can I do my best to prevent those arising? If I lose my mindfulness and this sense of aversion and irritation and so on arise, what kind of strategies can I employ or would be best to use? What kind of wholesome dhammas could I hope to develop in this situation? If they do start to arise, how can I take care of them? In that case, you say, "Yeah, when it gets very aggressive, I tend to reply aggressively." So there's a sila training, restraint training, that making, yeah, even if that person speaks with me aggressively, I won't respond aggressively. So it's so important to have that I call it pegs for mindfulness. So mindfulness means you bring something to mind, you bring it to bear on your mind. So, although it's a kind of a very basic Dhamma point, but it's bringing it to bear on the present moment in time to deal with present situation, which is the challenge, and just clarifying before the situation means it's right there in the forefront of your mind, and this is a specific goal of this, apart from the mundane goal of the business you have to see to. Yeah, this is my spiritual practice. I'm going to get through this whole meeting without answering back, or without, I can develop this goal of patience. I'm going to develop some patience today, and then afterwards you reinforce that by reviewing, and you say, "Well, I wasn't 100%, but that was a real improvement. That's really something to take, to rejoice." So recognizing also what you do achieve, and you reinforce that by this sense of anumodhanara, appreciation, rejoicing in it. So that means that it becomes much more likely that you'll be able to carry that on the next time. In the case that there is some sort of strong negative energy coming, whether it's physically, verbally, or whatever, I find the most useful thing is to ground something in the body. It's rather than some, you know, maybe it's like this or like this, but just to feel something just floats through your body and just out through your feet. Just let it. So allowing it to come in, but just to pass through you physically. But coming back to the physical. And also, when the attention is on the physical reality, then the unconscious tensing of the body is avoided. And with the attention on the body, then the mind is not going to proliferate and to react. So it's effective in many different, very different levels. So having, is this having these specific spiritual goals in terms of the four right efforts? And the metta is saying specific, someone has a specific unpleasant habit, personality trait, and so sort of a general may he be well or may she be well, it doesn't work very well, but then you're specific, say that may that person enjoy the happiness of freedom from aggression and irritation or whatever it might be, and metta is wishing well, wishing something well. What there's always something the opposite of the thing that's most difficult about it. If you prefer to answer it, ask in Thai, I'll answer in English. ความกลัวนี่มันไม่ลดไม่หยุดเพราะเหตุผลใช้ความรู้สึกในการกลัววิธีหนึ่งง่ายๆก็นิมนต์พระไปฉันไปเจริญพุทธมนต์บทน้ำมนต์วิธีที่ดีถ้าจะเชื่อในสิ่งที่นี้ก็เชื่อไปถ้าถือว่าเป็นจิตวิทยาก็เชื่อจะมองเป็นจิตวิทยาแต่ว่าเป็นที่ดีรดน้ำมนต์เจริญพุทธมนต์รดน้ำมนต์ให้ท่านแสดงธรรมถ้าจะกล่าวลักธรรมธรรมก็คือพุทธองค์ตรัสไว้ว่าผู้มีเมตตาเป็นที่รักของมนุษย์เป็นที่รักของงามมนุษย์นั้นผู้มีเมตตาไปที่ไหนนั้นไม่มีอันตรายมนุษย์ทั้งหลายเองอย่างหนึ่งคือการกลัวผีก็คือการดูแคลนเทวดาน่าจะมีอำนาจเหนือผีแล้วคนดีและเทวดาต้องอารักขาเทวดาดูแลถ้ากลัวผีหมายถึงว่าผีก็ต้องมีอำนาจเหนือเทวดาก็เรียกว่าเป็นการดูถูกเทวดาคือพยายามพูดเลยสำหรับพนักงานที่ยังไม่ได้เข้าวัดไม่ได้ปฏิบัติแต่ก็เอาเรื่องการสวดมนต์เจริญมนต์อุทิศส่วนกุศลให้กับฝรั่งทั้งหลายที่ฟังอยู่ในสุสานอ้าว There's a cemetery near the restaurant, and the staff are afraid of the spirits. And I suggested inviting the monks to go and receive a meal, and to chant, and to sprinkle holy water. So if there are spirits, they will respect that. If they're not, it's a great psychological value to the staff. But also pointed out that the Buddha said that one with metta, in heart, loving kindness, is loved by human beings and is loved by non-human beings. So the greatest protection against non-human beings of any kind is the power of metta. Also, there are devas, there are heavenly beings who look after good people. And if you're afraid of ghosts, it means that you consider the power of ghosts to be superior to the power of the heavenly beings who take care of wish all of us good people well. So I think it's a bit dismissive and disrespectful of these devas who come down to help us out. Question is, do we suffer because of ghosts, or do we suffer because of the fear of ghosts? So very few people have actually suffered directly from ghosts, but they have, almost everyone suffered from fear of ghosts. So the problem is the fear rather than the ghosts. And the more we send feelings of loving kindness hearted, and when we make merit, we share our merit with the departed, then we feel good in ourselves, but we also protect ourselves from danger, from amanu, from non-human beings. Buddha recounts when he was meditating before he became enlightened one of the suttas very interesting, because he recounts the progression of his meditation, his growing prowess with his ability to see non-human beings. So after a time meditating, he started to see these little whip, these little flashing lights in the trees. And then as he meditated more and more, they started to materialize as beings. They didn't know what kind of beings they were. And then, to summarize, he began to see them as heavenly beings from different realms, and then to be able to distinguish what realms they were, and so on and so forth. So it's a good sutta to study, response to those who believe that references to devas are a concession to the beliefs of Indian people of that generation. I don't think that view can stand up to any close study of Pali texts. humor helps. People feel that you're trying to show them the way, and you're doing something that's better and more valuable than they are, even if you feel that you're being quite subtle about it, then they may not feel that way. And just a sense of that humbleness and sense of humor. Do what seems right for us and best for us, and our confidence in this path is based upon the sense that we feel that this selfishness and greed is less than it was. We don't get so angry and so harsh towards others. We don't feel so confused or so depressed, and we feel this growing sense of generosity and kindness and stability in our lives and integrity. And so without going into specific teachings, you say, this is why I value it, because I can see these things, these negative qualities, less than they were. Maybe a long way to go yet. And I see a growth in these positive qualities, and this is why I'm committed to this. And so I think it, speaking in those terms, when it's the right time and place to do so, and being very careful to only speak about these matters when you're invited to. Like as monks, we're not allowed to teach unless we're invited, unless someone shows respect for the Dhamma. So if we're walking through White Salmon and somebody says, "Hey, you guys, what's the Buddha teaching all about?" We wouldn't be allowed to say, even though he'd invited us, because it's just not, the right time and place. It's not a learning environment. So, so if he says, "Oh, sorry," and then he sort of bows three times, he says, "Venerable sir," then we might stop for a few minutes and give him the short version. Yeah.
Thank you, Tata. And thank you all for coming tonight. Maybe we can end by